BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2pm on BCFM 93.2. This week, our weekly news and disabled people's update with Jason Yannakopoulos. More too with Peruvian-born genius documentary filmmaker Alan Frankovich, who died in mysterious circumstances in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1997. He documented black operations under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents and royalty. But first this week, the Soldiers' Charity, ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, and I'm joined by Andy Batcock. Hi, Andy. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Now, first of all, what does this ABF stand for? It's not just the Soldiers' Charity, is it?
We formed in 1944 as the Army Benevolent Fund, which might be known to some of your listeners out there. But in 2010, we had a name change and we became ABF, the Soldiers' Charity.
Now, it doesn't strike me as the sort of thing soldiers do, have a sort of makeover logo change. A lot of organisations do, but not soldiers, surely.
We changed 2010 because we became then an official registered charity.
OK. There are others, aren't there, as well? There's also the British Legion. There's the slightly different and much more modern, which seems to be more focused on the modern campaigns, things like Afghanistan, Iraq and things like that. Help for Heroes. But what sets you apart from those?
We are the Army's national charity. Like I said, we formed in 1944 and we've been going for 70 years and we support purely Army personnel, serving soldiers, former soldiers and their dependents as well.
So what about you? You're yourself a serving soldier, were you?
Yes, I served for 25 years in the infantry, yes.
And are you in the Territorial Army now, or whatever they call the reserves, or whatever?
Good God, Tony, no, too old for that. No, I am now officially retired and taking my pension.
Give us an idea of the infantryman's life. What is it like? What initially made you decide to go and join the Army?
I think it's one of those childhood dreams from running around the schoolyard all those years ago. It's something that it wasn't due to any lack of jobs around where I came from. It's just something that I really wanted to do, join the Army, and I never looked back.
OK, so yes, it's all very well to look at it with rose-tinted glasses, but surely some of it was tough. And also, there are all sorts of questions over whether what you're doing is right or wrong.
That's certainly correct. But again, from a charity perspective, I'm afraid I couldn't really comment on that. But no, from my personal perspective, as we said, they're rose-tinted glasses. If I could do it again, I would do it all over again. There's no change in that. I would relive my time in the Army because it's such a fantastic life. It gives you so many opportunities.
But the thing is, you're in a situation where you just got to do what you're told. Now, for a lot of young people, they don't particularly want that, do they?
No, but we like to encourage within the Army a thinking from the regiment I came from, a thinking rifleman perspective. So we encourage the people, the infantry soldiers under us, to think for themselves and to raise their hand if they feel that something's wrong.
So put your hand up. Don't get it shot off, but put your hand up.
Keep it below the parapet, yes.
Now, what about the charity? How do you do your work and who do you support?
As I said, we support all serving soldiers, former soldiers, those who are veterans and out in the street, and their immediate dependents as well. And we support them by means of issuing them grants to assist them to get them back onto a level pegging if they're in times of need, whatever need that may be.
Now, you can't help everybody, surely?
We intend to help absolutely everyone that we can, yes.
Because, I mean, one of the things that we hear again and again is the number of former servicemen who are homeless, for example. I mean, you're not helping all of them, obviously.
No, but we help those by issuing other charities that assist and help those guys. So we issue them grants. They apply to grants for the main charity and we give them out. Last year alone, we gave out £2.8 million to other service charities and non-service charities, helping exactly the people you're saying there, the homeless and people who are struggling with psychological disorders.
OK, so how much money are we talking about? What do you turn over every year and where does your money come from?
Money comes from donations generally from the public. Last year alone, we got £1.3 million from public donations. And obviously, we look at corporates and we write to other trusts as well to get our money in. But last year alone, we gave out in total £8 million, £5.2 million on individuals, such as giving them grants, helping the wounded, injured and sick soldiers to adjust to a new life as they're being discharged from the army. And, as I said, £2.8 million to other charities, non-service and service charities.
But it's a bit of a different job to most jobs, isn't it? I mean, again, I'm going back to you and your infantry days. It's not every job where you get called on to kill people.
No, that's true, but it's in line and service for your country.
The thing is, for a lot of people now looking at things like Iraq and Afghanistan, would you agree that people say, well, that's not quite what the British soldiering was about? For example, in World War II, there was a clear need to stop Hitler and the Nazis taking over Europe. In fact, they were right on our shores trying to take this country over. But there's none of that in Afghanistan.
No, I mean, the government went into Afghanistan to removed the base for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda as a base of operations, and they succeeded in that, yes.
Would you like it if the Afghans decided to come to Britain and say, oh, we don't like what's going on in Britain, we're going to invade your country, take it over and occupy it?
Well, no, probably I wouldn't like that. But that's...
OK, well, what about the charities' involvement outside the circle of the army? You've mentioned that you do help other charities which are, and other people who aren't actually in the army themselves. So how do you do that?
Again, they will apply to the charity for a charitable grant, of which is a board of trustees will sit down and look at it, and then they will obviously sanction that grant or say, sorry, not this time. But by the people that we've now given grants to, that's reaching out and touching a further in excess of 77,000 ex-serving soldiers who are out on civilian street at the moment and maybe struggling, and their dependents as well.
One of the $64,000 questions with the army has got to be, because there's a lot of youngsters, like you say, in the schoolyard pretending to play war, pretending to shoot each other. It's a very different kettle of fish when you're actually in it for real. What are the sort of options to actually get out of the army? I mean, once you're in, does that mean you're in for how long?
They serve for a minimum of 4 years, and then there's the chance to extend that service once they reach those manning control points. So the guys can do a minimum of the 3 to 4 years, or they can extend and push on to 22 years.
Andy, the reason you're in here is because we're also joined by Jeff Sparks, who does our weekly What's On guide. Now, Jeff, tell us why you're here too.
Well, I'm here to plug a benefit weekend in aid of ABF, the Soldiers Charity, which is on Friday 26th of July and Saturday 27th of July at the Reckless Engineer at Temple Way, Bristol, which is near Temple Mead Station.
Oh, it's the bottom of the ramp, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And on the Friday, we have three bands. Just confirmed, we have a band called The Eighth Bridge, a rock band from Cardiff. We have a band from Stoke-on-Trent called Hypothesis. And we have a local rock band headlining called Risen from the Ashes. And on the Saturday, 27th of July, we have a blues rock band from Port Talbot called Texas Flood. And we also have, well, we've got Texas Flood, Fell on Black Days and Bambi Killers. Those three bands are all from Wales. Bambi Killers are a female-fronted punk band. Fell on Black Days are a heavy metal band. And we also got local bands Alien Stash Tin, and headliners, the goth rock band Cowder Pavonis. And entry for this, for both nights, is by donation. And on a Saturday night, we will be having a raffle as well to raise further money for ABF, the Soldiers Charity.
OK, Jeff, can you just remind us of those dates again?
Yeah, it is Friday 26th of July and Saturday 27th of July at the Reckless Engineer at Temple Way, Bristol, at the bottom of the incline from Temple Mead Station.
The bottom of the ramp. Okay, yeah. Jeff, Andy Batcock and Jeff Sparks, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bristol Community FM, 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now some music. Mood Swings.
Sounds like a signal from you. Bring me to me your side. Signal, he calls.
I do know how.
From 1992, that's Chrissie Hynde and Mood Swings with a song called Spiritual High.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
US filmmaker Alan Frankovich made the definitive documentary for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing. The Maltese Double Cross was never repeated, but can be watched online. It presents compelling evidence of a secret motive for the US CIA to blow up the Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie on 21st of December 1988. Frankovich also directed a three-part Operation Gladio film for the BBC Time Watch series, which was shown to stunned audiences in 1992. It documented NATO blowing up European civilians and blaming it on the Russians, the Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof and even the IRA. Frankovich died of a suspicious heart attack in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1997. Alongside the feature films of the Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 1970s and 1980s documentaries give us a deep insight into the criminal side of Western intelligence agencies such as MI6, the CIA, the Israeli Mossad and NATO intelligence. All these secret political operations were deniable but carried out under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents and royalty. Alan Frankovich was interviewed in October 1982 by Alternative View in Austin, Texas, just after he released In Company Business, his film all about the CIA. Frankovich described the CIA as a kind of Rotary Club version of the Nazis' hated secret police, the Gestapo. And now, the final clip from that interview.
The CIA's been on company business for years, so what's been its job in France, Italy, Guatemala, Iran, Cuba, and the Congo? And what does Colby know, and Agee, Jackson, Braden, Nixon, Marchetti, Helms, Bundy, Stockwell, Church? And what about Truman, Ike, Kennedy? The CIA's been on company business in stealth. Now, we find out.
You mentioned a couple minutes ago that America had four major enemies, the Soviet Union and Red China, against those two. What are the other two?
Well, Japan now. In other words, because you realize the United States...
an economic rival.
Yeah. But you see, the way they have to look at it at that level, it's rivals. Mm-hmm. If Japan is outselling, if Americans are buying Toyotas here rather than Chevrolets, they're becoming a rival.
And Sony rather than RCA.
Exactly.
As a final question, can you tell us, during the process of making the film before and afterward, how it changed you, if at all?
Well, it changed me in the sense that I knew something about CIA operations, but what I didn't understand is the utter ruthlessness and the banality of it. In other words, that it happens day in and day out. That the people that are involved in this whole process, it's like talking to a bunch of insurance executives. They look at themselves as technologists. In other words, this is a technique for destabilization and destroy. They never come to the moral consequences, never have to face the moral consequences. And you're dealing with a kind of Rotary Club version of a Gestapo. Because they're smiling, they're affable, they're open. I can say that I got along very well with everybody I interviewed in the film. But nevertheless, if you look at what happens at the end of the process, and I had occasion to see that because my father was a mining engineer, and so I grew up in Latin American countries. And I had a very early awareness of the relationship between the United States and some of these other countries.
We were supporting every half-assed dictator, military junta, oligarchy that existed in the Third World, as long as they promised to somehow maintain the status quo, which would, of course, be beneficial to U.S. geopolitical interests, military interests, big business interests, and other special interests.
Have government agencies like the Congress, the Senate Committee, for example, to oversee the CIA, talking about the agency now being under control and that the abuses of the past have now been eliminated, as if the agency wasn't under control all along, and as if what they call abuses weren't ordered by presidents. The main argument is not with the agency, which is an instrument for policy execution, but the main argument is with the president and the people outside the CIA who determine the interests which have to be protected and how, who determine American foreign policy and then call upon the CIA and other agencies to execute that policy.
The system is what is wrong. The system is what has to be changed and should be changed.
That was the final clip from the interview from Alternative View in Austin, Texas, with filmmaker Alan Frankovich. He was speaking to the Austin, Texas VHS Video News magazine. And that, what they used to do was post out a VHS video in the post, and that's a recording which is available on YouTube. And we've got some more of those coming up in future weeks.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
And now our little review of some of the week's news with Jason Yiannakopoulos. Hi, Jason, and welcome to Dialect.
Hey, hey, how's things?
Not too bad. Now, I'm going to start this week, Jason, with some of the news about Prince Charles. As we've heard this week, he's been, well, not him, because, of course, he himself would never appear in front of a House of Commons select committee.
Of course not. That'd be out of the question.
Neither would he or his father appear in front of an inquest jury about the death of his wife.
Again, completely out of the question. That would be completely against protocol.
And there's no hint of the royal family being above the law, of course.
Absolutely not.
But Prince Charles' Black Spider memos are to be kept from the public view, rule judges. This is in last week's Guardian. So it's a publishing veto on Charles's letters. And the Guardian is going to appeal over this legal block by the Cabinet. Now, what's going on here is that Prince Charles is they're called the Black... It sounds kind of almost like something from a John le Carré book, doesn't it? The Black Spider Letters, or even the Hammer Horror Film.
What, you mean? What, you're suggesting it should be played with Vincent Price?
I think so. Well, taking the role of Prince Charles.
The late Vincent Price, obviously.
Well, yes, yeah, so maybe that's
Christopher
not...
Lee, maybe.
Yes, probably Christopher Lee, since he's still going. But the Black Spider is an interesting analogy, but apparently this is the black ink that Charles writes these various letters to government ministers. Now, I didn't know that he was allowed to do that sort of thing, to tell them this and tell them that. I mean, obviously, we can write a letter to a government minister, but they do have to listen to Prince Charles more than they do to us, because, of course, the Prime Minister has to have... Well, the Prime Minister, who's their boss, has a chat to, effectively... Prince Charles's boss every Wednesday afternoon, doesn't he?
And by his boss, you mean his mother?
That's his mother, yes. Yeah. It's been released recently that Prince Charles owns a massive tract of land he was trying to keep secret, which is Waitrose Distribution Depot near Milton Keynes. The other thing that came out, which wasn't quite so well publicised, was the fact that his mum owns the John Lewis Distribution Depot next door. So you've got, not only you've got the Queen getting profits from every single thing that John Lewis sells, you've got Prince Charles getting profits from everything Waitrose sells. Now, they're not going for the down market council estate customer, are they?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, that's this way. I was raised in the Royal Borough of Windsor and Maidenhead, where Waitrose is the biggest supermarket there. Although, right now, with the credit crunch experiencing some competition from Sainsbury's and Tesco's. But yes, it is surprising, isn't it? I wonder if that has anything to do with the fact that Dutchy Originals have, of course, a deal with Waitrose.
Oh, yes.
Originals, of course, are owned by the Prince.
Yeah, so, I mean, what is his constitutional position? This is a weird one, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if you can figure this out. Apparently, he's not a corporation, so he's not a sort of businessman.
Nope.
And yet, he does get a veto on laws if they affect him. So, apparently, Prince Charles is allowed to call in any law that affects his estates and his properties and simply strike it out if he doesn't like it. But it's an interesting constitutional position to have. How does that fit in with Britain as a democracy, Jason?
Well, it's not an entirely democratic position on the grounds that he was born into it. But from the point of view, you know, maybe if he's allowed to call into, any legislation that threatens the state, then surely all landowners should be able to do that.
Or maybe, yeah.
You know, if we're going to be equal and democratic about things, it has to be completely equal and completely free to all people who live in the UK and citizens.
I seem to remember we had a civil war, didn't we? Which actually abolished the monarchy and brought in a democratic system. didn't we? I think I was 1642 to 1649.
I think we might draw on the line at democratic. It certainly brought in a parliamentary system. Democratic, I think you're pushing it a little bit. But
anyway, you wanted to talk this week about autism. Why is that?
It's because I am autism, or to be more precise, Asperger. There's Asperger syndrome, which is slightly different from autism, but to the average person on the ground, probably close enough to be exact.
So what's the difference? Come on, what's the difference?
The difference is that somebody with Asperger's can form, can communicate on, verbally, that is, can communicate on the same level as a normal person, whereas somebody with autism will probably be stuck on a certain subject and maybe a little more, and maybe a little more obsessed. So we could have two people, one who is high-functioning autistic, one person is Aspergic, and the person who is Aspergic, you might think, is a better communicator, because they're more able to communicate on the verbal face-to-face issues, whereas somebody with autism might not be so good at that, because they generally struggle with autism. They struggle with communication in general. Now, on the whole, when it comes to communication in general, anyone with autism or Asperger's are pretty bad at communication, because when it comes to non-verbal communication, doesn't matter whether you're high-functioning autistic or Asperger, you're going to struggle anyway. And the reason I want to bring this in is because there's one thing that's annoyed me recently over the recent month. It is the stage version of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night Time, which is a play based on somebody who is autistic, and everyone's saying how great it is and how great the book was, that it shows autism in the light and it really helps you understand autism. But as anyone with autism or Asperger's syndrome will tell you, it really doesn't. It shows a very sort of almost like a Rain Man version, if you were, you know, if you have an overly autistic person, this is what they like. This is a stereotype more than anything else. And for somebody like me who actually has Asperger's, I find that really annoying. Because, you know, even some of the autism experts, they view this and they're like, yes, this is exactly what we see in a lot of autistic people, and they tend to treat you like children. So I think that's what you need. And the reason I've come here to talk about this a lot is just to show people that whatever your opinion on autism or Asperger's might be, the thing is, we're quite, especially with Asperger's, we're quite similar to normal people. You might have a few communications difficulties, but we're still able to do a lot of the thing that supposedly able people can do, and I'll put that in inverted commas, which of course you can't see because this is audio and you can't exactly see it in the studio. We don't have a camera in here, but I'm going to put that in inverted commas when I say able there, because of course everyone's got a disability to some degree.
Okay, so you actually sat and watched this play, did you? What was it called again?
Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night Time, even after the book. Apparently it's supposed to really represent autism, but the thing is, I'm Asperger and my father has traits of Asperger syndrome, and we couldn't read that. We just looked at it and we were like, well, no, that's completely overgeneralized. And this is the thing, because, you know, I come in here, I do a lot of things. That one thing I was proud of was I went to the autism show. If you remember, I discussed this a couple of weeks ago. I still often said the thing about Asperger's and autism is that it shouldn't be something that should be viewed as a disease or as a label. It should be something that can be embraced. And this is the thing I always see, because I get the question a lot, and actually the reason I've come here to discuss it today is because I got this the other day and it's annoyed me to the point where I think I need to go public with this. It's somebody asked me, wouldn't it be great if he had a cure to autism? And this is what always gets me, is that the autism experts would say, oh, yes, it'd be great because these people would be able to talk like normal people and act like normal people. But I think what people really miss, and this is the absolute point of why I'm discussing it today, this really crux point, is that for somebody with autism or Asperger's like me, we'd say, no, it isn't a great thing, because autism and Asperger's is part of who we are. We were born with it. We have it now. You know, you can't catch autism. It's not a disease. It's not contagious. It's not a disease at all. It's not something that can be cured. It's not something that's life-threatening or anything like that. It's just something you have. In the same way you know, I'm autistic in the same way that I'm male. I'm autistic in the same way that I'm Greek, half Greek, half English. I'm autistic in that way. Always have been it. I was born that way, and I always will be. And it's not something I particularly want to change, because to take away the, because yeah, you know, I've struggled with autism all my life. The fact that I struggle to communicate with people on a non-verbal basis, yeah, that's difficult for me. But at the same time, it gives me some positive aspects that when I'm really obsessed and passionate about something, I can really focus on that to a massive degree. Feel free to come in whenever you want.
Okay,
to.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think it's great, the point you're making, which is essentially that there's nothing different about me, actually, because of autism or Asperger's. That everybody, this is just a quirk, if you want, that doesn't actually affect who you are as a person at all. And it certainly doesn't need to be cured. And the idea that you can't be so-called, inverted commas, cured from it is no bad thing at all.
Well, no, it's exactly, because it's a thing that if I was to lose that autistic side to me, I'd become a different person, and I'm quite happy with who I am.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jason, we embrace you, and we embrace your autism, and it's not to be cured, it's not curable, and we don't care about that, because we want you for who you are, actually, and not for some other kind of version of a cured version of Jason.
I have an anecdote, if I've got time for
yeah,
this.
Yeah, go for it, yeah.
I have an anecdote. It was that, I was hearing a story whilst president of Disability Awareness Network about a man who was born blind, and he'd been blind all his life, and he was offered the chance to have a cure for his blindness. He'd been offered the chance to see for the first time, and he'd never seen his life. And so he took the opportunity. He had the cure. He was able to see the first time, but as well as seeing, and everyone thought it would be great to be able to see wonderful things like fluffy little kittens and blue skies and everything like that, but he was also able to view things as they really were, and he was able to watch sort of things like coverage from war zones and really horrific stuff like that, and he was so horrified by some of the stuff he'd seen after being given sight that he'd regretted the decision for the rest of his life. Not only that, but because he'd been so used to being blind that he'd built his life around that, and now that he could see, it kind of changed his life, and it changed the way he reacted to the world. And I'm very worried, especially now with disability benefits going and people suggesting sort of a new cure to you know, things like that, sort of saying that wouldn't it be great if things could be cured like that. I mean, obviously, there's some things that should be cured, like cancer, but at the same time, I think when people say things like that, they need to take a look. And when we're actually going into the whole thing about wouldn't it be great if we get these people off disability benefits and into jobs, you've got to look at how would that actually benefit, you know, if that is going to benefit the person, you know, is it going to benefit them positively? Are they actually going to be happy with what you give them? Because if they're not, then why are you doing this? You're damaging the person.
Well, I mean, I must admit, I'm pretty shocked by the... I mean, we had a news story, didn't we, just last week about disabled people not enough disabled people are in work. Well, actually, not enough people generally are in work. So why focus on the disabled people? It's almost as if you're implying that it's their fault, in a similar way that the people who are out of work, it's their fault that they're out of work. Well, hang on a minute, because if you go back a few years, there were enough jobs for anyone, and we're living in a society now where you've got structural unemployment. The whole point being that once you've got a big pool of unemployed people, disabled or otherwise, you can force down wages and pay and conditions. Now we're in the situation where you've got these zero-hour contracts, where people are expected to sign up for a job of work that's supposed to be a living, but they're not actually guaranteed any money or any work at all. So the actual rights that we've got as ordinary individuals are being forced down the whole time.
Well, absolutely. I'll find at this point that I am currently unemployed and disabled, but that doesn't mean that I'm not looking for it. It doesn't mean that I'm being lazy. I mean, I've had six, seven job interviews in the last month. I just haven't been fortunate enough to get the job. In one case, I was even told I was the second best candidate.
Well, anyone that thinks that that's your fault, I'm going to slap them. Yeah. Anyway, Jason, lovely to have you on again, and we'll have more from you next week.
Thank you, Tony.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now I'm joined by a small two-person band called Remez, though that is David and Miriam Zadok. Hi and welcome to Dialect.
Hello.
Now, first of all, Miriam, I'm going to ask you, where's this name Remez come from?
It's Hebrew. David can probably tell you a little bit more about the meaning.
Don't tell me. David dreamt it up, did he? Did you?
No. It's ancient Aramaic for allusion or hint.
Ah, right, okay. Okay, so what's the... we're already down in the Holy Land, aren't we? Is there some sort of influence in your music from there? So what?
We're promoting a new kind of music in Bristol in the southwest. It's ancient words, but put to very modern sound, or Latin, or Levantine.
Levantine, what does that mean?
That means from the Middle East, particularly. But you'll hear Greek melodies, Turkish, North African rhythms, and these will be blended together, but the message will always remain.
Okay, it sounds interesting. Let's have a listen. This is the first song, and it's called Times Like These.
In times like these, we all need something to believe in. In times like these, we all need something to lean on.
Thank you. That was Times Like These, the band Remez. It's David and Miriam Zadok. Now, the next one is called Yedidi. Did I pronounce that right? That's actually Hebrew. Even though it's probably pronounced with a slightly Cockney accent, Yedidi. What does it mean, Miriam?
It means my friend.
Whereabouts do you get the inspiration for these songs from? I mean, we've heard a bit from David before the last song. Whereabouts does it come from?
The song is in Hebrew from the Middle East. It's actually traditional songs, traditionally sung. There's a woman called Etty Ankeri. She sings these songs. She's from Israel.
And what's the idea is that you find the words and put your own melodies, your own rhythms to them. How do you develop those?
Yeah, that's right. We do like to give our own unique rhythm to the songs, and people seem to really like it. So, yeah, we get influenced by, as David said before, different places, really.
Okay, so let's hear Yeddy D.
ידידי, השלך חוצה חנותך בין שדי בין אמה חתני צמיתות למעבידי הלואס ולזוזורה רדתי איך
Okay, that was song number two from Remez and Yeddy D. Okay, finally, oh goodness, I'm going to have trouble pronouncing this. David, you better help me out.
Shkalim.
Okay, what does that mean? Is that, again, is that a Hebrew expression?
Yes, that comes from a word you might recognise, shekel.
Shekel, that's money, yeah? I haven't got enough shekels, mate. Yes,
this,
that's the sort of thing.
This is the solution to the current economic woes.
Really? Really?
Yes.
Fantastic.
It's actually moral.
In a song?
Yes, if I interpret it. But I'll give you sort of just the gist of it. It's basically telling people to put off the money that is coming to them. If they can defer it, it will come. If they try and attract it to them, it will go away.
Ah, this is an interesting one, isn't it?
This
is a sort of reverse logic when it comes to money. The more you seek it, the less will come your way.
It will actually.
Well, I mean, that's not necessarily the case for a lot of people, is it? I mean, you know, for instance, used car dealers, they're doing very much they can to get the money.
Yes, exactly. And they will know certain secrets. Never to sort of be too wanting or to sort of be too direct, to be neutral. And then they attract the goal.
Okay,
which is
so
obviously the money.
So there's obviously a bit of a moral philosophy with the songs.
Yeah.
Personally, where are you coming from? Where, you know, what are the, other than the songs themselves, what message have you got for the world?
The main message, the spiritual message, is money represents value. Human beings are valuable. In the Torah or the Tanakh or the ancient scriptures, Hebrew scriptures, people are equated to money. If they want to make a vow, for example, if a man wants to, a fully grown man wants to make a vow, he has to give 50 pieces of silver, a woman 30. It's not a sign of being inferior, it's the power or the force behind the vow. So people are often equated to money, and you've heard of blood money and ransom. People are worth a certain amount of money, and servants are given a certain price. And this is obviously known in the insurance world. If you have an accident, they actually assess how much you're worth.
Sounds like life insurance, yeah.
Yes, exactly. This is where these are ancient laws.
But isn't part of the problem that we spend too much of our time thinking about money and making decisions based on monetary values mm-hmm. rather than mm-hmm. human values?
Exactly. If you get the human value right, you get the money equivalent.
Interesting. Well, let's hear your final song then. That's, if I can pronounce it right, Shkalim.
Yes.
מצב קשה ורע לך ואין ממה לחיות לטובת תקווה חושבים עליך נשמות טובות תמיד עובדות שעות נוספות תשאיר הכל מאחריך כי הכסף רק נייר ובחיים יש עבר והווה ועתיד לפניך תחכה למחר עד שיהיה מיושר לגלות שחושבים גם עליך שקלים שקלים עלינו נופלים ומישהו איחר אותם לוקח אתה שבוי בהבטחות בלי כיסוי כי קשה את הכל אבל ממשיך לחיות חשבון בבנק הופך מובל ויש לך חובות נבצוע לשקל דורגים שתשלם הכל צמוד לתוספות על צברך יניחו חבל רק אם תשלם אם לא תילחם הם יעיחו לך בינתיים בעולם המחר אתה הופך מיותר עוד אחד עם חובות רק פי שניים שקלים שקלים עלינו נופלים ומישהו איחר אותם לוקח אתה שבוי בתחור בלי כיסוי כי קשה את הכל אבל ממשיך לחיות
was Shkalim by Remez, that is David and Miriam Zadok. Now, where can people hear you?
We're playing at Cuckoo Cafe on Gloucester Road in Horfield on Tuesday evenings, and Manor Restaurant on Friday evenings. It's in Henley's near the Downs.
Now, Manor Restaurant isn't spelled as you would expect it. Most of the manors in Britain are M-A-N-O-R, aren't they? This is a slightly different kind of manor, isn't it? Very much associated with food and the Bible. Tell us a bit about manor. What is manor? M-A-N-N-A.
Manor is the food of angels.
But is it what angels eat or what angels give?
That's what it says. It's the fare of angels, and it was given to humankind on condition while they were in the desert. So this proves a law, if you wish, that it is possible to eat food from another world and to survive and to be sustained by it.
Great.
Not natural food.
But what I really want to know is, what's the food like at Manor Restaurant?
Right, coming down to earth, the Manor, as in the restaurant, this is Spanish tapas bar. But we're going to make it angelic.
We're going to try anyway. Anyway, best of luck. Lovely to see you, and thank you very much for coming in. That's David and Miriam Zadok from Remez.
Thank you.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
The unique sound of Remez, David and Miriam Zadok. Great to have them in. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks very much to our studio guests, particularly to David Zadok and Miriam Zadok, and also to our studio engineer, Dave Bozanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. So thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
Thank you.